we trust. In charge we're not sure about.
Hello and welcome to episode 62 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. I am joined by Mark Farley and Lauren Malhoit. Hello guys. Woo!
We're still clapping. Yay.
What is that?
That's naproxen sodium tablets inside a box.
Is that what you need to get through the podcast?
I think so.
You beat me to it, Nigel.
So how is everybody at the moment? Anybody got anything interesting going on?
I've been a little under the weather.
Oh, no?
Yeah. We've got a little bit of the new winter's gunk going on, I think. So, yeah, we'll see. You know, it's the start of that season.
Hey, what's the weather like in California at the moment? Because we'll talk about this in a second, but I just came back from Barcelona, and it was like T-shirt weather in Barcelona for me. And I'm like, man, and then I land back in England, and it's like stick your thermals on and extra bed sheets and what have you. So what is it like over there in California?
Well, during the days, it's nice and warm. It can be t-shirt weather. Most people wear long sleeves and jackets in the evening. And at night, for sleep, you have to pull the blankets up.
Do you know what? That sounds like summer in England to me. T-shirts in the day and maybe a coat at night. Good grief.
And we're suffering for it.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. Hey, actually, Mark, so I think you mentioned a few weeks ago in the podcast you were raving about The Martian, the book. Because I think I'd read a book and was like, well, what can I read next? And you said, hey, The Martian's awesome, yeah?
Yeah, The Martian is awesome.
So I read it, or I listened to it, because I don't read, I listen. And I can verify what you said there. It was a great read. Now, have either of you guys seen the film?
Yes.
No, I tried to go see it last weekend, and believe it or not, it was still sold out. So
really?
Mm-hmm. Are you kidding?
No.
Because it has been out for a while, right? It's got to be several weeks now.
Yeah, I mean, it was a smaller theater, but it was a Friday night, and couldn't get two seats.
Wow.
What did they bill it as, James Bond?
That was also playing there, and perhaps that was sold out as well. So
right, the leftovers.
Maybe there was some overflow.
The queue that couldn't get into Spectre went to see The Martian again.
Yeah. So, Mark, you've read the book then, and you've seen the film. Is it worth me going to see the film?
No.
No. Oh.
Well, you know, maybe
I'm
in a few.
I'm probably going to.
Rent it later. It's,
right.
You know,
download it.
So let me ask you, what did you think of all the chemistry in the book?
Well, I followed the high-level stuff, right? And I wonder, right, because so I read all the Dan Brown books a while ago, right, and I thought they were all awesome, except the one that was about, can't even remember what it was called now, but one of them that he did was about technology. And because I work in technology, I was like, yeah, you know what, that's like ridiculous, and oh, that doesn't sound right, and ooh, and I was cringing as I was reading it. So for somebody like me who, yeah, I'm a bit of a geek, I'm a bit of a techie, but I don't really understand the science behind all of the awesome stuff he was apparently doing with his limited resources and stuff. I was fascinated by it, but I wonder, you know, if you really are like a chemist or an astronaut or whatever, you'd be like, what is this guy on? This is so unrealistic. But it totally had me hooked. And I was like, man, in fact, actually, so I finished listening to it on the plane on the way back from DockerCon in Barcelona. And as I switched it on, I thought, you know what? The whole thing is like, as a read, at least for me, it goes from like one kick in the balls to another kick in the balls, doesn't he? Like from one challenge to another. And it started to take its toll on me because I listened to it, to be fair, over only, I think, 3 days it took me to listen to it. And I was like, man, this guy's coming up against challenge after challenge after challenge. It was kind of weighing down on me after a while.
Okay, two things about that, right? You listened to the audiobook then.
Yes, yeah, and it was excellent. Yeah.
So did I. Terrific. Okay, yeah. Best audiobook ever, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You can hardly, you know, well, an audiobook, you don't put it down, but you just keep on driving, or you just want to keep driving around.
Yeah, and can I just give a shout out, Mark, to R.C. Bray, the guy who narrated it, right?
Absolutely.
I've heard him narrate several books now, and the narrator is so, so important to an audiobook. And anytime I get an audiobook and R.C. Bray is narrating it, I know that I'm in good hands. Anyway, so there you go.
Big winner, that R.C. Bray. So, so here's the thing, right? Andy Weir lives in Mountain View, and there's a NASA plant, or whatever you want to call it, a NASA research facility in Mountain View, mm-hmm. Ames Research Facility. My brew partner, Tony, you know, a rocket scientist guy, works at NASA. He works there at Ames, right? Andy Weir came in and he talked to, he came into NASA, right? And he, and this is before the movie and I think probably before the audiobook, and it was already becoming a sensation, right?
Yeah.
And the guys at NASA couldn't believe that he had actually figured out all of this stuff, right? But so to answer your question, did he just make this stuff up and did the scientists think it was crap? The answer is no. The scientists were really amazed. Amazed might be a strong word, but they were really impressed that this guy did the level of detail work figuring all of this stuff out.
Well, I mean, can you imagine how much time it must have taken him? Because there was problem after problem that he dealt with, right? And he went into, I mean, he was in deep, deep detail in some of this stuff. And not only did it still read well, which is like an art in itself, right? Getting into deep technical stuff and still keeping people hooked. But then if NASA is saying that, I'm just like, you know, whenever somebody has obviously put a lot of effort into creating something like the book, yeah, and it goes on to be a sensation, I'm just absolutely chuffed for them, you know, because I don't doubt, you know, that's not something that you write overnight. I mean, I know that no book is, right, but if he has done hard, hard research into that, congrats to the guy.
Well, apparently there was a guy at NASA Ames who had written things or, you know, was known for orbital dynamics and all of this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so when Andy Weir is talking to him, the, some guy asked the question about how did you, like, figure out or how did you, you know, calculate the orbital dynamics, you know, behind, you know, the slingshot effect and all of that.
Yeah.
And Andy Weir says, oh, so you're the guy, right? So Andy Weir had been researching stuff, you know, from NASA, you know, the stuff that's available and out in the public. And my friend Tony was really impressed by that, right? So a guy asks a question, he says, you're the guy who I've been reading, you
know,
is really, you know, and what Andy Weir said is he said it took him about 6 months to do the calculations and figure that stuff out. Now, I'm sure he wasn't working straight on that for 6 months, but the period of time that it took him to like make sure that he had that down right to include it in the book was about that period of time. Right, which is really impressive.
Let me ask: are there like a lot of crashes in the movie? I mean, does it? I don't know the entire story. Is it like terrifying to watch for those who are like terrified to fly, kind of thing?
No.
No. Okay.
No. They changed the ending, and I won't give that away.
Okay.
The ending's different, and I think the ending in the movie is a bit disappointing. I thought the book was plenty good the way they did it. The movie tried to sensationalize it a little bit more.
As they do.
Yeah, there's the initial thing where he gets hit by an antenna early on, right? And that's, you know, there's a big storm, a piece of equipment gets blown off a spaceship and it hits him and takes him out and they can't find him and the everybody else has to leave because it's getting to be critical. That's how he gets stranded there. So there's that. And there's one other place where there's a big explosion in the book.
I got to be careful about what I watch before I travel.
Well, it's not bloody. It's not bloody or bad. It's
no, I don't mind gore. It's more of actual crashing things from the sky.
Well, yeah, if you're worried about being stranded on like an alien world on your own, don't watch it. But
I don't know about you guys, but I never watch a movie like this in 3D.
No, I'm not a big fan of 3D in general, to be honest.
And it screws it. It gives me a headache.
Yeah,
me too. I take my glasses off and all that stuff. 3D doesn't work for me.
No.
So I didn't see – if that's part of your thing, Lauren, see it not in 3D.
Yeah.
You know, on the 3D thing, I'm sure we have got to be in like version 1.0 of 3D at the moment. Surely in the future it's going to be a much better experience than what it is right now. And our kids are going to look back and be like, what? You used to wear those ridiculous glasses that gave you a headache? And be like, yeah, it kind of sucked, yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. In the future, we'll be born and we'll get eye transplants that allow us to see in 3D and infrared.
Yeah, there you
evolution.
Go.
Evolution. Well, maybe we'll just be born with it.
Maybe. We'll be right. Better yet. So to kind of summarize, there's so many great details in the book, and he writes them so well, and the way Bray presents them as the narrator. You know, those, you can't do all that stuff, of course, in an hour and a half movie or whatever, right? And so it's the usual thing, all the tasty bits kind of get left out and some kind of important big bits get left out or changed. And to, you know, it was disappointing. I was so jazzed about the book that there was no way the movie could really live up to it.
Yeah, and I always find it a little bit of a dilemma that the movie's out there and it's really popular and what have you. And I know that if I watch the movie, I probably won't read the book afterwards. There's more chance that if I read the book first, I'll still probably watch the movie. But then it usually is such a letdown, isn't it? Which is kind of sucks.
Yeah, I'm the same way. If I see the movie, I don't bother to read the book because I'm lazy. I'm lazy that way. It's too bad. You know, there's great writing that I don't read because I saw the movie.
Anyway, okay, so we're going to say something, Mark.
Not just my wife saw it. She loved it.
All right, okay. I mean, don't get me wrong. I probably will watch it. I'll still enjoy it. It just won't be quite the same.
Well, give yourself some time, though, I think, really.
Yeah, like Lauren said, I'll probably download it. Anyway, so shall we shift on? I was at DockerCon in Barcelona this week, and you know what? I kind of was wondering how I was going to approach this because I don't want to be accused of being a Docker shill or a Docker fanboy, but there's just no way for me getting around it, right? Oh my goodness. It was just awesome. It honestly was. I mean, so I probably don't go to these kind of conferences and trade events as much as some of you guys, but I've been to most of them. You know, I've been to EMC World, VM World, HP Discover, Dell World. I've been to them all. And you know what? Kind of, I'm not a massive fan of them these days. And I think I've said this a few times on the podcast. You know, the bigger ones, I get just a lot less out of them these days than I used to. Anyway, I arrived back last night at like, you know, I don't know, just before midnight. My wife was still up and she's like, hey, how was it? And I was like, it was just the bizzo. I just loved it.
Great.
And I don't want to be too like, oh, it was awesome, it was awesome, it was awesome. And everybody would be like, oh, yeah, we know he's a bit of a Docker fanboy and what have you. And, like, fast forward to the next segment of the podcast.
No. Let's not fast forward. Tell us about it.
But I mean, just saying, you know, it was awesome, right? So yeah. I picked out three things here, right? So first up, it really feels like when you get there, right, it's just got a buzz about it that the other shows I go to just don't have these days. And this is a bit cheeky of me, right? But this time last year, I was at HP Discover. And DockerCon was on, I think it was the same week or it overlapped last year. And I remember being cheeky and saying to Calvin, hey, you know, Calvin Zito. Yeah, I was like, Calvin, no offense, man, but I really wish I was at DockerCon instead of at HP Discover. And man, if, well, I shouldn't say that really, but I'm at HP.
No, say it. I mean, whatever. I mean, you know, these big vendor shows suck. Let's just get that out of the way.
They do, yeah. So anyway, so there was this real buzz when you got there and you go on to the show floor and honestly, the ecosystem just feels like it's on fire. Now, I know it's early days, right? Okay. But the way I thought I could describe it, right, it's like, you know, when you get a new girlfriend and like everything's really cool and exciting. Yeah, it's like that, okay? I'm telling you, that is the best way I could describe it.
So is Dr. Cod like your mistress and HP Discover is like your wife?
Oh, man. I'm moving out. If that's the case, I'm packing the bags and I am off.
Hypothetical, not your actual
one. Oh, boy.
But you know what? You've got the feeling as you're walking around talking to the different vendors, they've got a load of excitement and what have you. It really feels like people are inventing stuff. That was another word that came to mind when I was thinking. Because you know what? Let's be fair, right? Docker's only 2.5 years old as a product and a little bit younger as an ecosystem, really. So there's bound to be a bunch of rough edges, things that can be expanded on, things that can be augmented. And you know, in those early days, there's just so many opportunities to augment and to build and to invent around it. So there was just this really great buzz. And I think especially potentially in the storage space, right? Because it's a bit of a weakness for Docker these days. I mean, the Docker storage story is okay, but it's not on a par with networking and it's not on a par with orchestration and it's not on a par with clustering. So there's all of these third parties that are springing up. And you know what? Like, NetApp were there, EMC were there, and they were all talking about, well, to be honest, to be fair, they were kind of, when I was talking to them, almost we were just bouncing ideas around as to what could be done. So, you know, it's just really early days and everybody's dead excited and it was, it's contagious.
So it's like what VMworld was like in 2006.
Absolutely.
Or 2005 or
yes.
Well, totally. Part of that perspective too, though, I mean, once you've made it to 4 or 5 VMworlds, it loses, but someone who's you know, first time out there. I wonder if they get that same, you know, new girlfriend feeling too.
Well, do you know what? So I'm going to say no. And this might just be me as an individual, but I've only been to VMworld once, and it was last year.
No.
And I didn't get that. But I will hold my hands up and say, yes, I am kind of as an individual bought into the whole container movement. And I do find it very interesting, and I'm heavily involved with it, right? And I'm not with VMware. So, you know, maybe so. I mean, is anybody new to VMware these days? Probably not so much.
So I think what goes on here, right, is people see a split in technology, and Docker represents that split. And you are smart to get involved in it, Nigel, and you're smart to continue doing it, because when things like this come along, right, and I think it's fair to say that there is enough momentum and enough interest in this that it is going to be successful, and people will make brand new careers with it.
Yep.
And it's that, and it, there's a passion, and people today, the people that are passionate about Docker will spend more time working on Docker than people that are passionate about VMware today. I believe that, right? Because there's more opportunity. There's more headroom. There's more space to go. And I just don't think you, I just say the passionate, I just don't think you get the same kind of thing. New technology is one of those things that is refreshing, that is exciting. It is like a new girlfriend, like you say.
Yeah.
And it's because people believe that they can become something else and something different, and they can discover new things. And those things are all wrapped together, right? It's not just, I'm going to get rich doing this. It's not like that, because geeks are geeks. But, you know, it's like, I can figure out something that no one has figured out before.
Yeah.
And you don't have that chance of discovery on a technology that's 10, 15 years old.
Agreed. You know what, as well, at the booths and things, they are loaded with senior engineers and the founder of the company and stuff, you know, the guy that's actually written the code for such and such a plugin or such and such a product that's going to wrap around Docker. And you get a lot less of that these days. You quite often get, you know, sales guys at the booths and semi-technical people. But this was loaded with people that actually wrote the software, designed the products and what have you. And those are like when I was a customer of technology companies, you know, when I was working in finance here in the UK and stuff, occasionally we would have what we call top table talent come over and talk to us about new products and pitch products to us. And it was like, I'm okay saying this to you guys, right? But it was always the guys that flew over from the States. You know, if they were flying somebody in from the States to talk to you, he was a top table guy. And they were going to know everything about the product. They could answer all your questions. They knew all the futures for it and everything. And you know what? Those guys were manning the booths at DockerCon.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was cool.
That's because these companies are small and they don't have limits on how many people can show up, right?
Yeah, yeah,
if you're
totally.
If you're VMware or EMC or HP or Cisco or Microsoft, well, Microsoft doesn't really do much at VMworld, but, you know, there's usually a limit of how many people the companies allow to go, or how many people they allow to go. And, you know, it's for cost reasons. And yeah, so the people that are involved in that newness, they go to this show. Whereas at VMworld, they might show up and do a keynote, but they're not in the booth. They're not really, you know, rubbing shoulders like that. They come in and out.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. So the second thing I thought I'd say is Docker Swarm looks awesome, right? So just in case there are people listening that don't really know what that is, it's just native clustering for Docker, right? So if you want to deploy Docker at any kind of a scale, so I don't know, like more than 10 Docker engines, and think of a Docker engine as like an ESXi host, right? Any more than 10, and it's just going to be a bit of a nightmare to manage. So Docker Swarm just lets you pull a bunch of them together. And instead of saying, oh, which host am I going to start this container on? You just throw it at the Swarm cluster, and Swarm deals with all of that for you, right? Now, I was just thinking,
is that like a name service or something for Docker?
It's basically a way of saying, look, I want to start a bunch of containers, but I don't want to decide which hosts to put them on. So I just say, Swarm, go and start 100 containers for me. And it says, all right, you've told me to spread them evenly, or you've told me to fill up one host first or whatever, and it just goes and takes care of it for you. Now, the thing is, right, so just wind back a couple of weeks ago, it literally was only that. I think Docker bought a company called Tutum, right? And I thought, you know, they probably would do really well if they could acquire Mesosphere. So I went on to Crunchbase and I had a look at how much cash Mesosphere had taken in. And they're taking in like about $100 million worth of venture funding. So I was like, okay, fair enough. Docker are not going to be able to buy them. But I really was of the mindset that, you know what? Because we've talked quite a bit on the podcast saying that they might struggle to make money. They've got a lot of mind share and they've got a lot of noise in the market about them and a lot of people are deploying them. But as far as Docker Inc. making money, not sure how they're going to really make a big business out of this. Anyway, we've often said that, and especially Gabriel, that some of the services you wrap around the core Docker technology is maybe where the money is going to be made. And Mesosphere is a great company there. And I was like, it'd be great if they could buy them. I think that's off the table. They can't afford them. But now that I've seen Docker Swarm, right, it just went 1.0 this week. And actually, they demoed it managing 1,000 Docker nodes. So that was Docker running on 1,000 EC2 instances in Amazon Web Services, managing 50,000 containers. And they showed you started and stopping more containers, so 50,001, whatever. And it was just, honestly, it was awesome. It just scaled so well. So I came away saying, you know what? Actually, I don't think they necessarily need to buy Mesosphere anymore. But I totally got the opinion right that, and shut me up here, guys, if I'm talking too much, right?
But No, this is interesting.
But Docker's always had this idea that, or this notion of batteries included but removable. So they say, we provide the core engine, right? And then we'll plug in things like Swarm and all these different things to orchestrate. But you know what? If you don't like our version of the stuff, you can pull it out and put in third-party software, Mesosphere, Kubernetes, things like that, right? It's been like an ethos for them, batteries included but removable. But you know what? Definitely at this DockerCon, there's been a bit of a change in, not momentum, but a change in the way they approach their ecosystem, I think. I really got the impression that they were starting to be quite aggressive and saying, you know what? These batteries are removable, but we're not going to make them cheap, crappy batteries anymore. We're actually going to make them really good batteries. And not necessarily kicking the ecosystem in the teeth, but really starting to play a bit harder with their ecosystem, which... it'd be interesting to see how that pans out.
Isn't Swarm free too, though?
Yeah, at the moment it absolutely is, yeah.
I mean, just to go back to your point of like, I mean, it's great, but how are they going to make money?
And you know what? And this maybe comes to what we'll talk about maybe later about Oracle's cloud and then maybe giving it away for free. I just wonder if there's something in this idea of giving stuff away for free. It's like dealing drugs, right? The first hit is free. And then once you're on it, it's like, well, you know, if you really want to deploy it and you want to put production on it and line of business apps and things like that, well, you might want to talk to us about paying for support and all that kind of. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Red Hat model. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, they were, in my opinion, definitely more aggressive towards their ecosystem, playing a little less friendly. Now, the last one, right? I think we all know that Microsoft are trying to get their act together around containers, and they've done a lot of joint announcements with Docker and stuff. So I went to a session that was run by a guy who was a kernel developer at Microsoft, and he just opened the hood on what they are doing at Microsoft to try and make containers work.
Oh, interesting.
Honestly, very, very interesting. And I'll say, right, so under Satya Nadella, Microsoft were a different company. We know that, right? And it was magic to see Microsoft being a lot more open about how things work internally at the company and internally within Windows, right? And they are no doubt doing an awesome job technically on the engineering front. But oh my goodness, what a mess it looks like inside the Windows kernel to try and make containers work. I mean, a number of times that the guy was basically saying, yeah, we're fudging this and you know what, we shouldn't really be doing this, but we're going to be doing that. And I came away being like totally impressed with them that they've actually got it to a point where it's working. But my goodness. So like, I'll give you an example, right? They've got this layer in between Docker and the Windows kernel that they call something shim.
Shim layer, yeah.
Yeah, and what he said was, he said basically the way that Docker talks to the kernel, like the APIs that the kernel exposes, they're not really very good for doing containers at the moment, and we know that they're going to change. So instead of exposing them directly, we'll put this shim layer in between, And as we, over time, make the kernel work better for this, Docker doesn't need to know about that. It just keeps talking to the shim, and we update the shim layer as we get our act together on the back end. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I thought of you last night, Nigel. I deployed my first container.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
Hey, just, all right.
Yeah. just on my local laptop, board at a hotel, thought I might check it out. But yeah, I have a Windows laptop. I'm the last of the Windows geeks, I guess. But yeah, they make you download VirtualBox to do it. So there's no direct to your Windows machine. And it's kind of cool the way they do it. They just do it automatically. You don't have to download VirtualBox yourself and all that. But
yeah.
But yeah, so I thought of you.
Well done. Congratulations. You know what? Even when Windows Server 2016 ships next year, he was saying it's still going to have the shim layer in because it's going to take such a long time. And I don't doubt that, right? Because Windows, I don't want to be negative to it here, because it's an awesome operating system, right? And it has been around for a long time. And containers are relatively new, right? And I'll be fair, right? Like all the hooks in the Linux kernel, they didn't go in overnight. They went in over years. Right, so Microsoft's got a big job on its hands. But
yeah, there's a little bit of discussion on this lately too on Twitter, and just some yammering back and forth. And it's got so many features, it's feature overkill for most people, right? Yeah. And Microsoft's always had the philosophy, well, we'll throw everything in there, and then whatever you want to use, that's great. But if you have to start backing some of those things out, the idea of Docker is just this, I can't even say it correctly, but the idea of this really lightweight, calling it a kernel is probably wrong, but it's like, why do we need any of this stuff? We don't want any of this stuff there. Everything that's in, I'm sure, in a Microsoft operating system just gets in the way. So how are you going to do that?
Absolutely. And this guy, right, this kernel developer, I mean, even he like had this wry smile on his face when he was saying, he was saying that, there's a lot of similarities between Linux and Windows and stuff. But he said, obviously Linux doesn't have the Windows registry. And he had a big smirk on his face with that. And he said, we've got NTFS as the file system, and it's been around for years, and we've been bolting onto it and this. And it's rock solid and what have you. But he's like, we can't just start stripping that kind of stuff out. But what he did say was interesting, Mark, actually, on that idea of a bloated operating system, right? He really gave the impression that Windows Nano Server is going to be the development platform of choice for server apps in the future. Now, that will take a long time to come into fruition. I don't doubt that. But apparently it's got like a 92% smaller footprint than Windows Server at the moment.
92% smaller.
Yeah.
There you go. There you go.
That's a story in itself, isn't it?
What happened to that nine? What happened to that eight? What happened to all that bloat?
Exactly, right?
Yeah, that's being unfair to Microsoft. Some of those things are, basically you would think essential services, right? But not necessarily for developers.
Yeah. And you know what? Not necessarily for a server operating system, right? To me, it's felt for a long time, right? Like Windows Server is a desktop operating system that is dressed up to look like a server operating system. I mean, it's a massive attack surface that you need to patch and protect and all that kind of stuff. In fact, he gave a funny example, right? So he said, here, I'm going to deploy a container and I'm going to deploy Python in it, right? Just the development environment and the programming language, yeah? And he said, but you know what? We have this issue that the Python installer for Windows, it doesn't just install Python. It goes away and it does all kinds of crazy things, like it wants to find Internet Explorer and install a favorite on it. And he was like admitting, it's not treated like a server operating system. We don't do just what's needed to get the job done. We want to put like a splash screen on it, and we want to put favorites on Internet Explorer. And he's like, we don't want people to develop server applications like that anymore. It was super, super interesting, and they are honestly doing a sterling job, no doubt, just to get it to work. I worry, right, that, I don't know, with all of the kind of fudging and whatever that they have to do and all of the workarounds and things like that, whether it will spoil the experience for, the container experience on Windows might not be quite the same as it is on Linux. And maybe by rushing it to market, they may shoot themselves in the foot in the long run. I don't know.
No, I think they have to do it, right? And Satya is the right guy probably to to be there leading that effort, because if they forgot one thing from their early years, which was get developers to develop apps for your platform, they certainly lost that with, you know, things like the Windows Phone, and, you know, lately it's people are moving to iOS. They see every piece that competes with them has you know, developer programs where people want to develop for it. If they're going to be relevant for a Docker-enabled world, they know, and Satya really gets this, they know they have to have legions of developers that really want to make their stuff work on a Microsoft platform, whatever that is. I bet it doesn't resemble Windows very much.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I think the days of Microsoft being the Windows company are going to come to an end a lot sooner than people think.
That's interesting, actually, because this is the kind of thing that makes me kind of pull my hair out at times, right? Every Docker image that you pull down, generally speaking, right, you pull it from Docker Hub, okay? Except that there's a legal reason that you won't be allowed to pull Windows images from Docker Hub. So you're going to have to go to some kind of Microsoft registry to get your base image. And the guy's like rolling his eyes saying, you know, we've just got legal reasons here that we can't host Windows on Docker Hub. And it's like, it's so frustrating. And I don't doubt it is for everybody at Microsoft, other than maybe the lawyers, that kind of thing gets in the way of engineering and innovation and user experience. You know, it's like they've got this cash cow in Windows that I will say, you know, I see Windows a lot in the enterprise, and especially things like Active Directory, that they are everywhere, and there's no better directory service than Active Directory. I'll hold my hands up, right? But when you've got a cash cow like Windows, we know from experience in other companies, don't we, it's so hard to like cannibalize that and say, well, you know what, for us to be the right kind of company in 2, 3, 4, 5 years time, you know, we need to change the way that we operate and, you know, stop using this as a cash cow and take maybe a short-term hit for a long-term gain.
I think Satya understands that. He's got, you know, however, you know, many people, you know, in that inner circle there, Microsoft, is it 160 or whatever? It's a huge number. Those people need to understand it. I don't know, just some do and some don't, right? And you know, the old business models, everything, you know, they're sitting on a ton of cash. You know, for them, it's a question of does the operating system work anymore? Is that a business that they even want to be in? You know, do they want to just have Office, you know, or whatever productivity aids? They need to be back in development tools. You know, there's a lot of businesses that they're in. Is the operating system business going to hold them back from putting everything out, from moving everything else into this new world? Because if they don't make it, if they don't cross into a Docker world, they're dead.
I wonder, how hard do you reckon it is internally for Satya to get that 100, 160 people or whatever on board with his vision? Because Microsoft's a big old company, right? And I don't doubt a lot of those people have been there a long time. They're entrenched in their ways. I mean, they're doing a great job in the cloud, don't get me wrong. And I think Office 365 is actually fairly decent. But how hard is it even for the top man like Satya to make such fundamental changes to the organization?
It's hard. It's a big company, right? And people will tell him what he wants to hear, but not necessarily what he needs to hear. That's the hard part.
It seems like they're turning the ship around, though. I mean, they're understanding these new technologies need to be embraced. And I think that will be helpful to them. So it's not like they're still, you know, thinking cloud is a joke and not acknowledging SaaS and PaaS and all that stuff. So maybe that makes it a little easier to at least tell the story. Now, actually executing is a different story.
You know, I've at times in the past, I've criticized Microsoft for hiring Satya because he wasn't an outsider. And I think the Microsoft culture needed to be broken, right? And I still believe that. And that's the thing that he's got to get past is the culture. But at the same time, now with the Docker thing coming in, and where it really is, it's tough technology to figure out for somebody running a company. Yeah, it's essential that they get it right. And it's essential that he drives that from the top down, you know. And for instance, I don't think you could bring in somebody from the cigarette industry like IBM did, you know, many years ago to run IBM. Well, the guy did a great job, right? And he transformed IBM from a product company to a services company for the most part. It was brilliant. And he had a lot of smart people working for him that helped him make that transition. Lou Gerstner, Lou Gerstner came from R.J. Reynolds Tobacco to run IBM. Everybody thought this is freaking nuts, right? I was thinking that Microsoft needed the same thing, and I was kind of disappointed when they named Satya. But I think the threats to the business are technologically deep enough that you actually need somebody that can get their arms around it and understand how critical it is to the company. That said, he's got cronies. He's got people that have sucked up to him forever. You know, and he's got to figure out, I mean, his job should be very lonely, and it's a hard thing to do. He's got to make these tough, tough calls, who to hire, who to fire, where to put resources, all of this stuff. They've been stacking all of these resources into Azure. Now they've got to figure out how to take same kinds of resources and figure out how to make all this stuff work in a Docker world.
Do you think he's doing a good job in general?
I do. Yeah, I do.
I mean, you know, I do.
Yeah.
The cloud business is awesome, I think, these days, really.
Yeah.
You know, considering Microsoft is Microsoft and where they've come from, right? Amazon Web Services had a big, big head start, and I know that they're still ahead, right? But Microsoft, they've got decent products and offerings in that space.
Yeah, I don't think the company resembles the Steve Ballmer company anymore.
No.
It is different. And so he's turning the ship around. He's got to continue to drive and turn hard. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, casualties and stuff along the way. And I know nobody working at Microsoft wants to hear that, but that's what he needs to do to save that company, or they will be irrelevant.
They're still one of the top three cloud that we talk about, though. I mean, it's amazing to me that they have stayed so relevant, honestly.
Right, right.
And I think it's great. Yeah.
But, I mean, so right, the world is still kind of thinking maybe we can make VMs work in the cloud, and maybe we'll have, you know, maybe we'll have some sort of bursting, you know, of you know, who knows if that's ever going to happen. But there needs to be interoperability of things. And the world is moving to a DevOps environment, right? The developers are going to rule IT in like 10 years or something like this, right? There's this transitions going on. And they're going to do it all, right? They're going to figure out how to make it work, and they won't need the same number of infrastructure and people. You're just going to flatten that out, and the people that mm-hmm. write the code are going to make the infrastructure work too. It's not going to be separable. I say these things as different things, but it's all going to be one big soup. And that's where the world's going. It's pretty clear. And Microsoft needs to figure out how to be there, and their cloud has to be there too, right? Because Amazon will do it, and Amazon doesn't care. Amazon doesn't care what the underlying technology that people use in their cloud is. Microsoft still has this thing. While most of the cloud users are still using Office, right? The thing that Microsoft really has to do is figure out how to make Office work in a Docker environment. And what does that mean? I don't even know what that means. I just said it, but I don't know. And what kind of APIs does it expose? Does Office become an invisible backend engine or what? I mean, there's all these things that have, you know, that are going to happen. And if they're beholden to old technology while they're making this transition, it will hurt them. And Amazon is not beholden to any old technology of any sort.
Yeah. And that is liberating, and it gives you wings and freedom that the other companies like, and we'll maybe talk about these guys later, but Microsoft and Oracle and people, they don't have.
But if you look at what he's done, right? You look at the integration of Linux, you look at the things that they're putting in Azure, and he's pretty much saying, we don't care if it's ours or theirs.
Yeah, and that's the right attitude, right? Totally right attitude, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's where it needs to go.
I almost wonder even whether, like, the lead guys for what's going on with Docker strategy and stuff like that at Microsoft should be the guys that are running the Azure cloud business, because they've got that right mindset that it doesn't matter. We don't want to force everybody to use Windows or whatever. We'll take whatever platform, and we just want people to develop on it and buy the service that is Azure, you know, rent time on CPUs and memory and stuff like that. Those guys really don't seem like they're beholden to the old Windows and things like that. So I wonder, I don't know, maybe those should be the guys that are leading up the Microsoft charge on Docker.
Yeah, interesting. I think they've got pretty good people running Azure, and I think they're going to continue to go to that open world, right?
Yeah.
I think they're going to move to open world. And yet they need to innovate. They need to provide products and services that people are going to buy in this new open world. And that's a challenge, right? Because everything's open. How do you do it? The old licensing model isn't the way we make money anymore. We're not printing money the same way we used to.
So
that's
true.
The thing that's hard, right?
So true.
How do they make a buck?
Yeah. Hey, so I think we talked a lot about that. Let me just quickly whiz through some tech news from the week.
Wait a minute. Don't we have a new segment this week?
Oh, yeah. Well, tell you what. Let's do the new segment. And maybe a little drum roll as we pass the microphone over to Lauren. Go on then, Lauren. Take it away.
Well, our new segment, and I'm sure maybe we'll rotate it around hosts, but this week we're going to do a hot or not segment, yes or no. So, yeah, I'm going to ask you guys, you know, it could be a company, could be a technology, a product, you know, just get a short, brief opinion on what your thoughts are on it. Hot. So this week we're going to talk
hot. How many
hot or not, or hot, I guess, H-A-W-T, hot. You could even do that. If Gabe were on, I feel like he would say like hot or something. Gabe's always he's a little more into the here and now than I am, but anyway, the new Lenovo announced that they are going to have a $150 laptop available. Best Buy will sell it $150, kind of a stripped down laptop. So in this day of, you know, the Surface being sold for $2,000, you know, I don't know that the Chromebooks ever did too well. Anyway, I've said enough. You guys give me your opinions, hot or not. Mark?
Not.
Nigel, not.
But you go first with your explanation for what you think, Mark.
Okay, not.
Hey!
Not. But I would love to have a little thing that I could just, like, whip out from underneath the couch.
You know? You what?
I want a little thing.
That you can just whip out.
From under the couch. I want a little portable thing that doesn't take any power, that the cats won't eat. And like when I want to look up something, I just want the ultimate like little digital appliance there. But my guess is it'll perform so badly that, you know, you'll end up just throwing it into the fireplace after a while.
You don't get that awesome little thing that doesn't consume any power for $150. That's the problem, in my opinion, right? So generally speaking, you get what you pay for, don't you? And you are surely, for $150, you are paying for a crappy experience. I mean, I imagine the battery lasts all of 10 minutes and it's got to get so hot that you could fry an egg on the thing probably. For $150.
Well, you just called it hot.
That's a
feature. You called it hot.
Yeah, you got me on that one. The thing is, right, so for me, okay, my laptop is my life. It is absolutely my life. And you know what? I will pay for a slick experience there. And I know not everybody's like that, because not everybody takes their laptop with them literally to the toilet and everywhere. But my laptop goes everywhere with me, and I do everything on it.
What if you could have one of these tucked in underneath the sink?
No, but again, here's the thing. Yeah, here's the thing, right? For $150, it wouldn't fit in the sink cabinet, I don't think. You don't get something slim and sexy in laptops for $150. That they tend to look like bricks. And I'm not saying this particular one. I have looked at a review on it, and it's not necessarily a brick, but it's not what I want. It is not hot, in my opinion. Not hot.
It is not hot.
Not
it's an 11.6 inch high def screen with a decent battery life and weighs 2.2 pounds, this particular model. So
I wonder
it's not
if I
huge.
Could take in, I wonder if I could take in my old Surface 1, the original Surface that I got when I was a Microsoft employee, and trade it in at Best Buy and get one of these things, like
you know
even
what,
up Mark, trade.
Your Surface 1 is probably better. That thing is going to take 15 minutes to boot Windows 10. I'm telling you. We're laughing. It is. It's going to be a three-legged dog.
Well, I think the consensus is not. And I agree. Why not just buy like an Amazon tablet for $35 if you want a second device to whip out from under the couch?
Did you say second device or sucking device?
Either. You choose.
No hots.
What do you think, though, Lauren? What do you think?
Yeah, I gotta go with not. I think
you're
I would
saying that. No.
I think I would spend $35 on, you know, an Amazon tablet and have it for movies when I'm flying and have it a Kindle built in and the Amazon store and all that good stuff, you know. I don't know why I would need a second crappy laptop.
So
$150 is too much.
So the question is, I don't think I would even buy this for my elderly mother.
No.
You know, because she would never be able to use it. Mm-hmm. I turned it on, and I couldn't do anything with it. Well, you have to wait half an hour for it, Mom.
Yeah.
I put it in the microwave, and it still wouldn't work.
Shall we shift on then? So let me just rattle through some tech news, right? So VMware open sources its Photon controller. It also announces vRealize Air compliance, some kind of compliance packaged as software as a service. Anyway, Docker announces Universal Control Plane. Maybe talk about that on another episode. I do think that's awesome. That's Docker attempting to get into the on-premises side of things. Rather than just being cloudy, but we have talked enough about those guys this week. Business news, right? Apparently Oracle is doing all kinds of funny business to inflate its cloud figures. And in not great news, Citrix to axe another 1,000 jobs. I think they axed about 1,000 earlier on in the year. And they're also going to be spinning off their go-to business unit as Elliott Management does what it does, sinks its teeth into the organization and quote-unquote restructures. So that's what we've got. Now, business news, right? I'm kind of interested in this Oracle Cloud thing, okay? We've talked about it probably 2 out of the last 4 episodes, bit of Oracle and a bit of cloud. But I've got a quote here from InfoWorld, if you just bear with me on this, right? So InfoWorld is, I love this, quoting an anonymous but senior executive within Oracle. Yeah. So what the account teams are doing, and I'm quoting here, right, is seeding cloud deals within larger deals. So if a customer does a $10 million deal, we're throwing in $500,000 of platform as a service. The sales rep gets his accelerator of 5x or 3x on that 500,000, excuse me. And he said, I've seen this on 90% of our large deals. It's still booked as a sale and it goes through the appropriate approvals with account reps and getting credit and stuff. But in reality, it's being given away. Somewhat amusingly, the customer's IT staff are not even aware of the inclusion. Now then, a load of interesting things in my opinion around that. But I thought, right, so they're quoting some anonymous guy, so I think you have to take it with a pinch of salt. I'm not having a pop at InfoWorld here, right? I mean, good grief, I've written enough stuff for them. Maybe I've written my last piece for them. But no. But the thing is, right, you're quoting an anonymous source here. And then just, I think, was it the last line didn't really ring true with me. So he's talking about deals in the region of $10 million here. And then saying, somewhat amusingly, the customer's IT staff are not even aware of the inclusion. Well, you know what? I have been through contract renewals, not with Oracle, but with storage companies. And let me tell you, we go through them with a fine-tooth comb and we are dropping every single line item that we don't think we need. And I just find it hard to believe that customers that are spending multiple millions of dollars with Oracle can have something to the tune of 500 grand slip in under the radar. That doesn't ring true to me. I don't know.
So the thing that's credible about this is that in a lot of respects, that's how Microsoft started with Azure. The stuff was bundled in to existing enterprise license agreements. And I think your experience going through the license agreement with a fine-tooth comb might be a little bit unusual. Not so unusual, but there's still a lot of customers that don't have the ability to do that. And stuff gets in there and it's through and bingo. You know, so I worked for StorSimple, and before StorSimple was purchased by Microsoft, we had a deal with Microsoft that would help Microsoft reps retire quota. If they sold a StorSimple unit with cloud storage as part of the deal. One of our challenges inside Microsoft after we were acquired was going in and finding these boxes. They're finding our boxes that were still in the shipping boxes customer shelves and getting them used.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so these deals are big and it happens. And Microsoft did it that way. And it allowed Microsoft to fund more development of Azure. And now, you know, it's a going entity. I think, you know, at a couple of years ago, the big challenge for Microsoft was getting people from just having cloud licenses to actually using it. I think that's still an issue for them. More people subscribing than actually using. And in Oracle's case, I think it's just hilarious. You know, Larry is talking about this trajectory they're going to be on. You know, in fact, when they're just when nobody's using it at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's if Flattery is copying someone, they are flattering Microsoft, and it worked for Microsoft.
My question was, is who's using these PaaS services? Like, are people, you know, actually using them for what? I guess I just haven't really encountered many companies using it. So, you know, Microsoft was going somewhere with Azure. Well, I feel like there's maybe a difference there as far as just the technology.
Maybe. But you know what? I do think there is something to the notion of, because I imagine, right, that you renew the deal and there's, let's just take that example from InfoWorld, right? There's 500 grand's worth of Oracle platform as a service in there, right? I imagine that's probably going to be a 3-year deal. And within that 3 years, if the account team follow up and if they can start getting you to implement things on their cloud platform, move the odd service across given time, I don't know, maybe it's a semi-decent long-term play that, you know, well, we've got X amount of cloud available in Oracle. Let's go kick the tires on it. And I don't know, then once you're in, and we know with Oracle, right, once you're in, once the hooks are in, oh dear, it's hard to get out. So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder if it's seeding potential future users of their cloud platform. I don't think very many people are using it at the moment, to your question, I think, Lauren. But I don't know, maybe it's a decent plan to have a handful of people using it in 2 to 3 years' time.
So the thing about the Oracle's cloud is they don't have anybody driving it like you have the CEO of Microsoft driving it.
I don't know. Is Larry not talking about it a lot now? I mean, I know he's not.
Larry has a lot less hands-on to do there than he used to, right? Whereas Satya Nadella is trying to save that company by doing the cloud. You know, everything we were talking about earlier. Right, they've got multiple pivot points that they've got to figure out. They've got to figure out cloud. They've got to figure out Docker. You've got a guy that's engaged doing that, you know, 16, 18 hours a day there. I don't think anybody at Oracle, there might be people at Oracle doing it, but I don't think they're necessarily drivers. I mean, the only, you know, I've never worked in Oracle, so I don't know who the other driving people are. Larry tends to make them go away.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And, you know, I tell you this, Mark Hurd's not going to get this done.
No,
if Mark Hurd
no.
thinks he's going to do a cloud, you know, that's a joke.
I feel like we have to go back to the question Nigel asked last week or the week before. What are people using, you know, an Oracle platform or Oracle cloud platform for? You know, we know what Google's used for. Well, maybe we do. We kind of talked about it. We know what kind of people are driving towards Azure, what kind of people are driven towards Amazon. So what are the use cases for Oracle? What kind of people are being driven there?
So here's a true story for you, right? I was sat down in one of the session rooms at DockerCon yesterday, so Tuesday, we're recording on Wednesday, and a guy comes and sits next to me and he starts talking to me. The session hadn't started, and we got talking about Oracle. And because we've been talking about it on the podcast, I thought it was an Oracle customer. I thought, I'm just going to test the water, see if what he says resonates with what we've been saying. And we talked about the Oracle Cloud, and he absolutely backed up everything we said, that people will not want to get into bed with Oracle on their cloud platform because they have been burned working with Oracle account teams in the past. So to your question, Lauren, I think it was your question, who would go to the Oracle Cloud? It's only going to be Oracle customers. You know,
right.
No new developers that are, you know, building net new born in the cloud applications, not a single one of them is going to go to Oracle for their cloud platform. But their existing customers, I don't think they want to. Getting into the cloud, a little bit like what we were saying at the beginning of the show about Docker, it's a life and company and career and world-changing technology, right? And people get excited about it, and it's a way to reinvent themselves, get their new careers and stuff. You know what? The cloud is the same for companies. It is an opportunity to get away from the old world in some respects. And there will be precious few, in my opinion, existing Oracle customers that will say, hey, we're going to pivot onto the cloud, and by golly, we would love to partner with Oracle to do that.
So in our analogy, Oracle is your first wife.
Absolutely. And I cannot damned her. She has fleeced me for every penny I have, and she is not getting a penny more.